This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the Mecklenburg County Commission turns thumbs down on funding a stadium for professional soccer, opting instead to find money for parks. More failures revealed at the Mecklenburg County Health Department by its new leader. A panel of federal judges gives the legislature until 5 p.m. September 1st to redraw legislative voting districts. A committee of members of the UNC Board of Governors recommends barring centers and institutes at the university from being involved in litigation. And the PGA tees up in Charlotte. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Guess what? Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. And Doss Helms is the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Kirsten Garris is government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. And Glenn Berkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. But we're broadcasting on a shaky camera right now on Facebook Live because they keep moving it around. And you can also get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. So whiplash is the big word this week. Whiplash at this week's Mecklenburg County Commission meeting. They decided against funding an MLS soccer stadium. Wow. Dealing a big blow to MLS for Charlotte and our chances of getting a team. This seems like, I think it was the Charlotte Observer in the editorial this morning used the word stunning. In terms of this move, it was a surprise, wasn't it?
Apparently to even commissioners.
To a lot of us, it was pretty surprising, including city council, who was gifted with a Memorial Stadium and Grady Cole Center, which I don't know they were expecting that gift.
Or that they even want.
They have to accept it. It's one of these things where they kind of just placed a stadium and an indoor arena on the doorstep, rang the doorbell, and ran away.
Exactly.
Trick or treat.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it appears that Commissioner Ella Scarborough was the big surprise because she was the deciding vote in all this, and it confused some commissioners because Commissioner Jim Puckett had proposed the county not put any money toward the deal, but simply give the land to the city for the stadium. And then here's what she said.
Doggone it. If you're going to be a major city, let's be a doggone major city. And major cities have major things. Soccer is one of the major things that needs to happen in this county.
So now her vote, if I'm not mistaken, contradicted that comment.
Yep.
Right?
Doggone it, she voted against it. That's exactly right. And it was twice, you're exactly right. It was a real head scratcher because she gives part of what we just heard, that impassioned speech that soccer, you know, it's going to help put Charlotte on the map. This is a major thing. We want to do it. And then this proposal comes up that was billed as a compromise. But it I think that's an overly generous use of the word compromise from commissioners who did not want the county to be spending money on a private stadium. And basically what the deal was is they were like, look, instead of spending this money, and they have agreed before this, they had agreed to spend, what is it, $43 million roughly on construction costs plus loaning the private group MLS for CLT $75 million in order to help, you know, that they would get repaid, but in order to help finance everything else. She'd voted for that all ahead of time, and she being Ella Scarborough, and then you have this idea of, we don't want to put any money in, so let's do this. Let's just give the Grady Cole Center and Memorial Stadium to the city. They've got tax revenue that's specific for use for tourism purposes. They've already got two stadiums. They know how to deal with it. We, the county commission, don't know how to deal with it. Let's make this their problem.
So she makes this impassioned speech in favor of the county being involved in this soccer stadium.
Seemingly.
And then she votes against it. And here's what some of the confusion sounded like that transpired around her vote.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Madam Chair, I thought you said you were opposed to it.
Yeah, and you just voted the opposite way.
Yeah,
no, she did not say she was opposed to it.
I'm not opposed to it because it does include soccer.
No, it doesn't.
This
motion does not.
It says we limit.
So some board members then asked Jim Puckett to re-explain his motion to make sure that Scarborough understands it. And Trevor Fuller also underlined that a vote for Puckett's proposal was a vote against soccer.
Our contribution to Major League Soccer is Memorial Stadium and Grady Cole. That is what we will give. That will be our participation in Memorial Stadium into soccer. We will not take away funds from something else and add to it. We will give them the asset to use. That is the motion.
And what I'm saying, Madam Chair, is that if you vote for this motion, you are essentially voting against MLS.
Right.
You are. I mean, that's your whole point.
How?
Okay, now you're trying to say that you haven't been trying to say no to this deal since the beginning?
Okay, so that last question.
Who's on first?
That last question was directed at Ella Scarborough by Trevor Fuller. So what was her answer? Did she understand what she voted for? Why the confusion? This is amazing to me.
Well, technically, they're not banning soccer. They're just saying, sure, soccer's fine as long as somebody else
pays
does
for it.
But realistically, you know, the county was kind of out in front. They were more supportive of this soccer deal than the city was, just so to say, let's hand it off to this body that's still sitting over there saying, oh, we don't even know if we want to get into it at all.
I've not seen a post-vote interview with her. Has anyone done one to ask her if she understood it? Because it does seem that she was under a different impression, but who knows?
Or maybe she was just saying, soccer is good, it should come here, but we shouldn't pay for it.
No, I don't think that's quite it either. I mean, again, fall back on the speech that you just played from her. And the confusion even, it extended beyond just the conversation with the county commissioners. At one point, Chairwoman Scarborough asked the county lawyer to explain what the proposition was. And he's like, you know, I can tell you what it says. I can't tell you what the ramifications are. You guys have to figure that out. I am just the lawyer here to explain the details. You have to know how this works. And they did this really strange procedural trick, which is after the first vote that Ella Scarborough cast, they hadn't officially announced the tally, right? The counts of yays and nays. We'll call it arcane, but it is still part of Robert's Rules of Order. If a vote hasn't been announced yet, they can retake the vote. So they did, which caused Commissioner Reitenauer just to say, this is basically a travesty. And I mean, it was just such a head-scratching moment.
But it turned out the same way.
It turned out exactly the same way.
It was very interesting. And I think what we also need to mention is that at the 11th hour, they had a couple of compromises kind of thrown at them, first with that earlier that week with Monday from Dina DiIorio saying, hey, we can do both soccer and fund some parks. Right. It will take time to fund the rest of the parks, but we could do both. And then literally hours before the meeting, we get this letter from the four commissioners who've been against soccer from the start, all three Republicans and then Democrat Pat Cotham. They're the ones who kind of started planting the seed about this idea of let's pass on Memorial Stadium to the city, kind of, again, saying, hey, we're all about human services. We're not the group that handles entertainment and sports ventures. This is really the city's thing. Let's maybe pass it on to them since they know better how to handle this.
So somewhat of a surprise was the fact that they pretty much changed their minds about this, because back in January they took a vote on this and it appeared that they were very much in favor of it.
They were very much in favor.
But it was still a close vote in January. Let's not forget.
Yes.
This was never a landslide vote. It was still very close. And
County Manager Dina DiIorio was very, very much in favor of it. She found all this money, and then she found money, as you said, Kirsten, for parks, because that seemed to be something bubbling up from underneath. She found money to fund some of these parks. The big surprise then was Ella Scarborough.
Yeah, and her vote is really important too, because Councilwoman Vilma Leek was gone. So you had eight commissioners there that night. So if Scarborough had voted in favor of this, it would be a 4-4 tie. Well, guess who breaks a tie in the case of a tie on a county commission?
I have no idea.
The chairman or chairwoman, Ella Scarborough. So her vote was absolutely critical, and that's why there was such a fight from both sides to try to make sure she was on their side.
Exactly.
You mentioned the parks, Mike, and I think that's – we focused so much on this yay or nay on the soccer stadium, but – however, whatever combination of politicking or confusion or whatever led to this, it is sort of a victory for democracy in a way, in that there's not any big outside interest group lobbying for parks and greenways. There's not any billionaire family. But there have been a lot of people coming to these meetings and saying, soccer's nice, but what we really want is a park in our neighborhood, a greenway in our neighborhood. We approved bonds, which is not a pile of money sitting there, but it is authority to borrow. You know, we got a promise of this in 2008. Here it is almost 10 years later. And now that's what's going to move ahead.
So. And I think that's part of the story. But I think underlying that is just a backlash against using public money for these types of deals. According to Forbes, the Smith Empire is worth $1 billion. And, you know, most of us, when we go out to start a business, we aren't able to go to taxpayers and say, hey, write us a check to help us start or grow our business.
And there's an article on the front page this morning of the Charlotte Observer about Marcus Smith and having to figure out how to go to the well now to figure to be able to do this. And if the city takes control of the Grady Cole Center and Memorial Stadium and then gives it to Marcus Smith's effort to get soccer here, that's $30 million in land value going to a billionaire. People don't like that, evidently.
I think a lot of people probably have a problem.
Although that's how the Panther Stadium was built. We gave them the land and the infrastructure improvements, right? And they built the stadium.
That's true.
But the NFL, well, let's put it this way. Soccer is not the NFL.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the thing here? If this had been the NFL, this would be a done deal?
Yes,
I question that, actually, because let's think about the giant round brick building that's not far from our studio right here, the Spectrum Center.
Spectrum, yes.
Let's not forget that the original bond to build that stadium was voted down. But and that's the NBA in Charlotte.
But even the NBA is not the NFL. The NFL is really in a different league when we talk about fan engagement.
Right. And I think you have to go back and get a little history lesson on the voting down of the Spectrum Arena originally. And that had to do a lot with a bad taste that was left in the mouths of people in Charlotte who just didn't like George Shinn.
Sure, the original owner. Yep, I know the story, but I think it is still a fair thing to bring up because it's one of the few times when you've actually seen a direct way to measure the public's appetite for spending public dollars on a private sports franchise.
So the winner here is the parks, and they approved $49 million to be spent on the parks. Is that the amount that voters approved a decade ago when they approved the bonds for parks, or is this less than the original amount? Do we know?
That I actually can't clarify. Yeah, I'm talking my head. But at least it is the 13 remaining projects that were left on the bonds. I know that is what they're fulfilling. And that was something that, again, back in like May when they were doing budget talks, that's what people came to the budget hearing to talk about. They said, hey, we've had these parks on the bonds. Mm-hmm. We need them fulfilled.
Okay. And they were about to expire, if I'm not mistaken. You only have there's a sunset on bonds that
aren't issued. I wondered about that. Yeah, I think there is.
Yeah. City Council now has to make a decision. Are they going to take Grady Cole and Memorial Stadium, and are they going to put any money into the pot for this MLS for Charlotte effort? City Council does have a means of funding this kind of thing through their tourist tax, the hotel motel tax, mm-hmm. but they had been backing down on the amount that they seemed interested in forking over in recent months. Does the county walking away send the city's interest in this project to zero now?
Well, certainly the initial reaction seemed to be sort of what ours has been of, wait, what just happened? I think they've been trying to figure it out. Councilwoman Julie Iseult said, it's like your great uncle dying and leaves you the family house and it's falling apart and has back tax.
Right.
Yeah.
She said, we didn't want to spend $30 million before. Why would we want to pay it now? So they're not jumping up and down with joy.
And City Councilman James Mitchell, who has been in favor of the city participating in this, thinks this does put the kibosh on it.
Not having the county to put in their financial commitment, I think it's a deal breaker. I think for us, it was about two governing bodies working together to do something special and bring a professional franchise.
This could be a first for Charlotte, couldn't it? We said no.
It'll be interesting to see.
To a shiny bauble? We said no to a shiny bauble.
I mean, honestly, James Mitchell was the first person I called after seeing this vote. I was like, I have to see how he's feeling because he has been the soccer fan since January when he was alone and no one else was like feeling soccer. He was the one like, we got to figure this out. So even when I called him that night, he said, look, I don't know. It's a new deal. So they have to evaluate it.
That's Kirsten Garris, a reporter a government reporter for Spectrum News. We have more to say about soccer, and we're going to move on to other things as well. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeast Digestive Health Center. The practice is expanding to help support the growing community. A second location at Edison Square in Concord will be open this summer to serve patients' GI needs. More info at northeastdigestive.com. And Live Nation presenting Government Mule with special guest Galactic tomorrow at Charlotte Metro Credit Union Amphitheater. Tickets available at livenation.com. Some of the top names in professional golf are about to join an estimated 200,000 spectators in Charlotte next week for the PGA Championship. It's our first time hosting a major golf tournament. Well, I don't know what the Wachovia is, but that's what they're saying. While pro golf has played through Charlotte's Quail Hollow Club for years, that's the Wells Fargo. The championship will take the golf scene to an elite level. Guest host Eric Spanberg will preview the tournament and look at the stock market rally and your paycheck and more Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Trump's immigration revamp, Scaramucci's sacked, North Korea's missiles, Russia tensions. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after the Charlotte Talks Friday News Roundup, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're intermittent today on Facebook Live. Those of you who are watching us, all three of you who are watching us on Facebook Live, the camera keeps going out. We're sorry about that. So rely on good old trustworthy radio. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News. That's on television. You guys have a more reliable camera system. Is that right?
We do. Channel 14.
Okay. And Dawes Helms here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. There's no camera, Ann. Wave at the camera. And Glenn Perkins.
Somebody out the window. Okay.
Glenn Perkins, editor and publisher of Q City Metro. Marcus Smith is fronting the effort to bring Major League Soccer to town. He heads the ownership group team. And he has said, I believe, that these funds have typically been available, and if they are available, you'd be silly, fiduciarily irresponsible not to go after these funds. Mm-hmm. Now these funds suddenly have not become available. What's the likelihood that he will proceed without them? Does the MLS care whether it's a public-private partnership?
I don't think the league cares. They just want to have a stadium and have it be state-of-the-art within view of a downtown or centrally located in downtown. I think the league has made that very clear. How likely is he to proceed? We'll find out. I mean, that's the thing now is the soccer ball, see what I'm doing here, is firmly in his net. I mean, that's – the county has made a statement. The city doesn't seem to be making much of a statement other than –
we're evaluating our options. That is the city statement.
Yes,
but judge that as you will.
Hasn't Major League Soccer said that community support is one of the four factors they're evaluating?
Sure.
And this is not a sign of overwhelming public enthusiasm in Charlotte.
Well, on the part of the elected officials. But, you know, I think –
but, again, if the constituents – if people were filling the chamber saying, we love soccer, spend the money, you know, this would have turned out different.
And there has been no hue and cry over this vote by county commission that I've detected. There are no letters to the editor, no nothing.
Not at all.
Yeah. On Twitter, again, this is the millennial talking. On social media, a lot of people that night were asking, well, is soccer dead in Charlotte? And the answer is no. Soccer isn't dead in soccer, and Charlotte isn't on life support. Maybe. And again, that's the question to Marcus Smith is, how much do you want to pay for soccer?
What are you millennials doing now that Donald Trump's not tweeting every day? anyway, so does this tarnish Charlotte in the eyes of the MLS? I'm hearing you say, Ann, yes.
It seems to me that it would. I'm no MLS expert, mm-hmm. but that if you figure we're competing against 12 other cities, it seems to me there have got to be four cities that have more enthusiastic bids than we do.
Or at least more solid bids. I mean, here's the thing. A league looking to expand it always is going to say, we want to see community support. However, most of the money for leagues, including soccer, don't come from ticket sales. They come from television deals. And we're a pretty significant market that can bridge a significant gap in their overall television coverage. That's the skeptic in me. And, you know, Ann, your point is completely valid. I'm not sure exactly how much of a weighted, you know, vote they'll put into community organization. But I do want to say one thing. MLS for CLT did actually release a statement after the vote, and it says that we are not giving up on bringing Major League Soccer to Charlotte. To win an expansion team, we need a strong public-private partnership that works for all sides in the future. We will keep working hard to make this happen as long as there's engagement on the public side. So what does that say?
Well, I don't know.
That's where we all come back to.
I'll tell you what I think that says. I think that says that Major League Soccer needs Charlotte more than Charlotte needs Major League Soccer. This is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. Mm-hmm. Major League Soccer would be crazy not to want to get in, particularly at this juncture.
I don't know. I've talked to all these sports people a couple of weeks ago, and they were all saying, nay, 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 you're not going to get it. It's going to be Cincinnati. It's going to be some other city. I've forgotten what it is now.
Sacramento.
Sacramento. So maybe
well,
you're right,
Sacramento
though.
Was maybe. Cincinnati, I don't see so much.
Okay. So when will the city pick this up and make a decision one way or the other?
They are going to talk about it in their Economic Development Committee on September 14th. They were supposed to talk about MLS funding options later this month, right. But that was under the impression of the original deal. So now it's been pushed to September to kind of figure out where do we go from here.
So the clock ticks on. The Mecklenburg County Health Department has been in turmoil this entire year. They uncovered sloppy operations, low staff morale, inefficient leadership. The director resigned. Now the department's interim health director, who had nothing to do with any of this, has uncovered more problems. What did Alma Gibby Harris have to say this week?
Well, it's going to take 3 years and nearly $5 million to fix the health department. And on top of that, an internal audit by the county commissioners found that over the past 3 years of evaluating their pap smear notification process, they found out that 95 more women had not received proper notification about getting follow-up treatment. And so that is uncovering a
process. These are additional women?
Yeah, this is additional. So separate from the 185 that we found out earlier this year. And this is from over a three-year period. And that is, again, an internal audit that the county wanted to do to figure out, well, how is our notification process? They wanted to go back a step further. And that was actually a call by, if I'm correct, Commissioner Bill James to kind of take it a step further. Let's see if this is a problem that just happened last year, or is it something that has been happening? And this revealed that it has been happening for quite some time.
Are they going to look into, since this has been happening, are they going to look into outcomes of the result of what this has done to people?
Yeah, well, actually, in that meeting, Gibby Harris and the audit auditor said that what they did, since they saw this flaw, that there were 95 women, they don't have evidence that they received another notification letter and may have received that treatment. They said, okay, let's send them letters and calls now just to make sure. And Harris says now those women who may not have gotten a notification, they're now setting them up for follow-up treatment. So they are trying to, again, kind of go back and say, okay, let's be extra cautious now. Let's follow up with everybody just to be safe and get them in if they need it. So, I mean, it's another list to the litany of problems they've been facing.
So earlier they were saying it would take about a year to sort through all this and fix the problems. Now they're saying 3 years and $4.6 million. What are taxpayers paying for? What are we going to get for our money for our $4.6 million?
That's the question Trevor Fuller asked, was what are we getting from this? And Gibby Harris said, you know, that to have a state of a state-of-the-art health department, it's harder to find what that is. But actually, Dina DiOrio had an interesting point that night. She said, you know, their goal is to have a health department that when the commissioners or you or I go into the health, go to a doctor, it's the same kind of care we would get going to a private doctor. They want to make sure that anyone who comes to the public health department gets that same kind of treatment, same kind of health care. And right now, Dina DiOrio says they don't get that. So that's their goal, is to make sure treatment is up to par.
Some of the specifics they've talked about is creating two more assistant health director positions, one that would specifically be overseeing the clinics, better use of electronic medical records. They're saying we have electronics, but they're essentially being used like an old paper file, not being used in a modern way, outsourcing some lab tests in hopes that they'll be done more reliably or more quickly.
And they want to be able to have customers, patients, use their computers to check their own records and, I think, make appointments or things like that.
And get the results instead of using a snail mail, basically, a paper mail to you and you get in your mailbox. It would give you a chance, you know, to be able to check your records a little bit more quickly.
And government agencies around the country in all kinds of uses seem to be way behind the curve on the use of that. And usually government agencies charge an extra fee for that, which a private business would not charge. We'll see what happens there. This week, another clock started ticking on the effort to redraw 28 legislative districts, which have been declared as having been illegally, racially gerrymandered. A panel of federal judges gave the General Assembly until 5 p.m., September the 1st. They put a time on it, exactly 1 month from their decree to fix the problem. Here's Allison Riggs. She's the senior attorney at the Southern Coalition for Southern Justice, which represents the plaintiffs in this redistricting case.
The court wanted them to focus in on what the task is at hand, which is unpack these districts, stop sorting voters on the basis of race, and let voters know that it's getting fixed.
So there seemed to be some irritation on the court's part that the legislature was taking its good, sweet time. time on doing this, right, Tom?
Oh, I would say a lot of irritation. And this is the original federal panel that found these 28 state House and Senate districts were, in fact, illegally racially gerrymandered. Their decision was later upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'll give you an example of how frustrated the panel is with the General Assembly. Here's a quote from the decision. The General Assembly does not appreciate the need to move promptly to cure the unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. And then they added no evidence that the NCGA provided no evidence to support their contention that they need 3.5 more months to remedy the constitutional violations identified by this court almost a year ago. So, yeah, they were miffed, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So the General Assembly originally said, hey, we need 3 months to do this. We really want to take our time to do it correctly, even though this is using the same data that they used back in 2011 to originally draw these. And that's one of the more controversial parts, for sure. That's Dr. Tom Hofeller. And he's an interesting character. I mean, you know, take aside the partisan. And he is a partisan. He makes maps, district maps, for Republicans. He is clearly extremely good at what he does, but he uses some techniques that have more than just raised eyebrows. He uses big data and analytics to come up with things like this really fascinating technique called the efficiency gap calculation. And basically what that does is it tracks wasted votes. And an easier way to basically say that is they can draw districts in a way where even if one party has a minority of overall votes, they can win a majority of overall seats. That's how specific and mathematic this process is. And that actually is controversial. It is still legal to gerrymander districts for partisan advantage. That may change this next Supreme Court session because they're taking up a case in Wisconsin. And guess who drew the Wisconsin maps in question?
Him.
Yep.
That's actually happening nationally. If you look nationally at all of the congressional votes cast, Democrats traditionally win more votes than Republicans, but Republicans have more seats in both houses of Congress. But getting back to something that Tom said earlier, what the panel said about remedying the constitutional violation, I don't think you can remedy the constitutional violation until votes are cast. And strangely to me, they did not say that we should hasten that vote. So we're going to just vote in November 2018 as we would have always done. I guess part of me understands that. But on the other hand, if they believe that there has been a constitutional violation, I was a little bit surprised that they didn't.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Glenn, 100%. I mean, this is the same panel of judges that ordered a special election be held last year after the original finding. They did, and that's the funny thing about this. It was a three-judge panel. It was a unanimous decision, but it was, in fact, a split decision because whereas they held that, you know, you're going to draw these maps and you're going to do it quickly, they did not. In fact, they said they denied the plaintiff's call for a special election, which means we have yet another General Assembly regular session before this remedy takes effect.
Is that why, when you reported on this initially this week, you called this a win for the legislature?
That part is a win for the legislature. I think that is absolutely clear. The legislature, you know, they don't want to have to go through a whole other election cycle before they even get to the next.
But now why, if you're the legislature and you've been haggling over this with the courts now for months, and the court says you have to do this again, why would you bring in the same guy who did it the first time, who's very good, as you said, at drawing Republican districts? Aren't they running the risk of having the court say, mm-mm?
Possibly, but let's face it. This guy, Tom Hofeller is very good at what he does, and there are a million different ways to draw maps. What the court found here is three words: illegal racial gerrymandering. So you can take race out of that to a certain extent and still find ways to draw those districts to benefit you or your party. And that's, I'm sure, what they're doing. And what's also interesting is they're paying him a fee. This is a national, you know, map drawer. He's based actually out of Virginia, but he does this all over the country. And one of the more interesting things that happened with the first redistricting committee meeting, and they'll hold another one later today, is Democrats asked if they would have access to Hofeller in order to see how he would draw, you know, the districts to benefit them. And the Republicans said, no, nope. But we'll give you money if you want to hire your own consultant.
So once this fellow does this and redraws these districts, how do you test them? How does the court go back and say, okay, this passes muster or it doesn't? How do they do it?
How in the weeds do you want me to get here? I mean, in particular, there's something that they're going to be testing the districts on, which is it's some people who are familiar with this term, the BVAP, the black voting age population. That's one of the big keys. That is a measurement by percentage of African Americans in a particular voting age African Americans in a particular district. In the districts that were found to be illegal racial gerrymanders, they saw the BVAP percentage over 50%, which means you have effectively packed African American voters into specific districts, which dilutes the influence of their vote in other districts. That's what's illegal. It's supposed to be equal protection, one man, one vote.
Because what you've done is throw them a bone. You've said, okay, you can win in these districts, but you're going to lose everywhere else.
I actually think it's worse than that. What happens is if you concentrate them into a set number of seats, you are diluting their influence in a larger number of other seats. So you're really minimizing the overall impact of their vote.
And is the basis for this racism, or is the basis of this politics, the fact that African Americans are probably more likely in most cases to vote for Democrats rather than Republicans?
I'm sure there are people who are going to talk about this as being one or the other. I think, frankly, if you just want to look at it from a partisan lens, because I can't answer the heart of your question. Okay. I don't know the specific people well enough to be able to tell you.
Nobody does.
Right.
Really.
You never know what someone's motives are. You know what the results are. And the results are it comes out both.
Okay. So that's the legislative district. We still face redrawing of congressional districts, correct?
Kind of. I mean, here's the interesting thing. The Supreme Court, again, earlier this year, found that two congressional districts were also illegally racially gerrymandered. But those maps were already redrawn. So the ruling was for the original crazy shapes of the North Carolina 12th, which was here in Charlotte, and then did the literal snake up 85. And then out east, you had the first congressional district, which was like this octopus sitting on the North Carolina-Virginia border with its tentacles kind of hanging down all the way almost to South Carolina at one point. I'm waiting to see what the courts say if those redrawn maps are perfectly fine, because they dramatically changed the shapes. And what they did there is they took race out of the map-making program. So instead of having it be based on race, they had it be based on like party affiliation, voting, all that kind of stuff. That is the same technique that we may see with the state legislative districts redistricting.
Okay. So 5 p.m., yep. September the 1st
tick, tick,
is when
tick.
This is due. And after that, when these new maps are submitted to the court, how long will the court take to decide whether this is okay, whether you have to do it yet again, or whether the courts will take that task upon themselves to do? Because they can do that, right?
Yes, they can. They can order a special master to redraw the maps themselves if they choose to. That is extremely rare, but it can happen. They are impaneled to do that. You've done this a long time, Mike. You know that nobody can tell you exactly how long a court is going to take to do a darn thing. So we don't know. But the court will definitely weigh in on this. And since we are not having a special election, they have time to do that. But we'll just have to stay tuned. And there is an update, actually, because now that the General Assembly has the court guidance, they're speeding up the process. They actually now say that they'll start voting on new maps on August 18th. So that's roughly two weeks prior to the court's mandated timeline.
All right. UNC's Board of Governors has proposed something that has some people's hackles up. We'll talk about that when we come back. And the PGA is on its way to Charlotte. And we'll also take a look at all the money pouring into the mayoral campaign when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Urban Lumber, specializing in producing wood products like mantles and tables from repurposed trees that come down in the Charlotte area. More at CarolinaUrbanLumber.com. A grand jury is impaneled in the Russia investigation, another spin of the revolving door at the White House. A new chief of staff is in. The communications director is out. A Republican immigration proposal gets little support in Congress, and North Korea flexes its dismissal muscle once again. Just some of the stories they'll be talking about during On Point, coming up in 20 minutes during the National News Roundup here on WFAE. And we will continue with our local news roundup with our roundtable of reporters coming up in just a moment. Stay with us.
The never-ending cycle of breaking news alerts can make the world appear cluttered and confusing.
Premiums and deductibles for lower-income
market chains fell in the news of the Amazon Whole Foods deal.
Down to the meaning of one phrase, bona fide relationship.
That's why NPR is making space for clear, concise journalism and memorable stories. Make some space for yourself and stand with the facts. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly local news roundup here on Charlotte Talks with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Dawes Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News. I want to apologize to our Facebook Live viewer. Evidently, the audio cable broke, and all they could see was a silent movie. So we have moved on. You'll have to listen on radio now, which is a good thing. Radio is a good thing. It's a miracle. How do they send sound through the air without wires? It shouldn't work. This week, a committee of the University of North Carolina System Board of Governors voted to bar the school's Center for Civil Rights from engaging in litigation. And yesterday on this program, the director of the center, Ted Shaw, reacted to this move.
This is about academic freedom. It's about what's taught and how it's taught and whether we can have experiential education. And this is an ideological hit, as I said to the committee of the Board of Governors. That's very clear. I mean, I think that people want to dance around that or pretend that it's something other than that. But that's clearly what it is.
So how did the committee explain its decision? Why do they want to do this? It's only a recommendation at this moment. They're not going to vote on this until September, but why do they want to do it?
Well, this has all sort of been the project of Steve Long, who is a Raleigh tax attorney, and he's a member of the Board of Governors, but not actually of this committee, but he has been campaigning very hard, saying that this is not something that a taxpayer-funded educational institution should be doing. Teach them about this, talk about the issues, but don't get involved in litigation. And he is a former board member of the Civitas Institute, which is a conservative organization, but he says it's not anything about political ideology. If it was conservative, moderate, liberal, I'd still be against it. And so he has apparently made that case that this is not the best use of energy and money for a public institution with the committee members.
And other board members, and maybe Steve Long as well, have said that having institutes at the university engaging in litigation is straying from the academic mission, and that it was improper for parts of the state, in this case the university, to sue other parts of the state.
Yeah, which is an interesting question, considering that this is attached to the UNC Law School. And
they're actually giving students a chance to litigate.
That's right. And, you know, that's one of the counterpoints to the arguments that Mr. Long put forward that Ann was describing. And, you know, he's not alone in this argument is actually pretty popular. I mean, what was really interesting to me is there was a letter that was presented to the committee where you had, you know, the former dean of UNC along with 600 deans of law schools saying this is actually an important technique to teach students. So you may or may not like the fact that you have a branch in effect of the UNC system suing different parts of the state government, but you can't say that it is not about learning, because regardless of whether or not you like their motives, this is experience. This is the equivalent of, say, a residency for a doctor. It's a chance to do your trade.
And can you legitimately say that this recommendation on the part of this committee of the Board of Governors is not about ideology? I mean, Steve Long said, and I quote, "I don't care what the Civil Rights Center's political ideology is. If it was conservative, moderate, liberal, I'd still be against it. I'd still put forth this proposal." But they clearly are more progressive than Steve Long and the Civitas Institute.
Well, and again, it gets down to you can never be sure of somebody's motivation. You can hear their words and you can see their actions, and actions usually are the thing you follow. And there certainly has been a trend since the Republicans took charge of state government to crack down on institutions that are affiliated with the university system that tend to have progressive aims, like the Poverty Center. So,
and if you're familiar, if you're familiar with the Innocence Project, which has gotten a number of people out of prison who were wrongly convicted, those types of things are embedded at a number of universities. So it's not entirely unusual for a state-funded university or a body of a state-funded university to challenge another part of the state government system. So you know, this isn't entirely new.
So what has the UNC president had to say about this?
Margaret Spellings hasn't really said anything yet, and that's to be expected. As the president of the UNC system, she is not supposed to take stands on something until it's actually presented before the Board of Governors itself. And remember, this is a committee. It is a small subset of the Board of Governors overall. So we'll see. But she also brought up the need of the, you know, the, every aspect of the UNC system to focus on, you know, experiential learning.
Right.
Well, again, now we're about to see how she defines that, because you've got Mr. Long, who says that's in the classroom. You've got the center, which says that's in the courtroom, since you're, you know, dealing with law students. So we'll see what happens.
So the Board of Governors meets in September to actually vote on this proposal, which was by a committee. What has been their track record? Do we know? Do they normally follow the recommendations of committees, or are they likely to say no to this?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Okay. All right. We're about to be descended upon by golf fanatics. 200,000 people are expected to attend the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow Country Club, which starts on, I think, Monday of this coming week. All reports indicate
Friday.
The tournament starts Thursday.
Yeah.
Delays and stuff next week. But the tournament starts Thursday.
You must be a big golf fan. You're already trying to jump the gun there.
You're just ready to go.
Tom, I only know what I read in the paper. And
I was going to say, I've been seeing August 7th through 13th.
Exactly right. Yeah. And I was out at another country club down there on Carmel Road yesterday, and there are already remote parking lot signs up all over the road.
There are practice rounds. There are pro-ams. Yeah. There are a number of things leading up to the actual
tournament. There you go.
But traffic will be bad starting next week.
Exactly.
There you,
probably there. Monday, because they're having shuttle buses from downtown to take people out there. We've hosted other PGA events, the Wells Fargo for one. Why is this so much bigger?
This is the championship. I mean, you can call it the Wells Fargo Championship.
I
mean, but
the golf scene, I don't understand this. I don't know anything about
it.
Wait a minute. The Masters, didn't the Masters just...
Yes.
Isn't the Masters like the first big tournament?
Yes.
That was like a month and a half ago, and here it is August, and this is the championship. But there are more golf tournaments coming up in October, in September, aren't there?
Yeah.
Why is the PGA in the middle of the season?
Well, you've
also got the Super Bowl in October.
I mean, when you're done, Mike.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay.
Get off my lawn.
Get off my hole, I guess. No, what it boils down to is you can quibble with the name and whether or not it's a championship, but this is like tennis. There are four Grand Slams in effect,
okay.
And this is one of them. And it is a huge deal in the world of golf. And so, you know, to say you're going to see 200,000 people coming down to see different aspects of this over the time span, yeah, I mean, it is a big, big deal.
And it will be a big impact on Charlotte. Whether that's a big gain or a big pain depends on where you stand. Lots of people coming in means money coming in, money being spent. There's going to be really bad traffic in a lot of spots. Garbage collections are being rescheduled.
Really?
There are apparently.
Can't have that.
We have been told that more than 800 media credentials were issued, and you know how Charlotte cares about its image. So that is a whole lot of worldwide golf media who are going to see Charlotte in August.
Okay. And talk very quietly as they see it.
And we know that Glen Eagles Road is going to be closed to traffic between Quail Hollow Road.
All right, I'm sorry I started this.
You started something bad, Tom.
Yeah.
From 6 to 9 p.m. every day. Is that the only road that's being closed, or do we know? Just prepare for
that's
great
the
delay.
Main one. But it's safe to say find other ways of transportation.
If you live in
or avoid it.
If you live in Southeast Charlotte, this is the week to go to the beach. All right. Now that the field for the mayor's race is firmed up, we're beginning to learn about how much money is involved in this race. Is it a surprise that Republican Kenny Smith begins his campaign with the most cash on hand, $308,000 at last report? How does that chunk of change compare with the Democrats?
It's a lot.
Yeah, no, it's significant. I mean, he I think it's also significant for a very specific reason. Although Kenny Smith, who's a city councilman, obviously the Republican candidate, or sorry, a Republican person trying to get the nomination for mayor, he does have two primary challengers, but neither are considered. I mean, both are considered long shots, frankly. So he can hold on to all of that money
for the general election.
For the general election and continue to raise it. So yeah, it is a big, big advantage, but. Overall, and we can talk, I'm sure you'll want to talk about the Democrats and what they're raising so far, but overall, this is something I was running through the reports, adding up the numbers, and this is something that just absolutely fascinates me. Overall, if you add in the big four, you have Jennifer Roberts, Phil Lyles, Joel Ford, and Kenny Smith, they have raised $1,112,233 as of June 30th.
That's a lot.
If you're not impressed, Mike, let me give you some context here. You ready?
Yep.
That is just $130,000 shy of the record set in a Charlotte mayoral race. And that record, that's back in 2009, that record was set in November after both primaries and general elections, after all of the overall fundraising is done. That's months away from these
so
folks.
So why is the money pouring into this race this time?
Well, I think this is a real sign of that we are not Vegas. What happens in Charlotte does not stay in Charlotte. And we had some things that got a lot of attention, starting with, and I'm going to have to put a dollar in the jar, the ordinance that led to the infamous House Bill 2 and Jennifer Roberts.
Came up three times yesterday.
Okay, so it's never really gone. We can bring back the music. But Jennifer Roberts was a proponent of the LGBT protections bill that included, right. Things about where transgender people could use restrooms. And so she is getting from inside and outside North Carolina a lot of financial support from LGBT rights groups and individuals who are prominent in that scene. And then, of course, Raleigh was not crazy about what we did, and they fired back with their own response to that and then blamed Charlotte for all of the bad things that ensued from that. And Joel Ford, who is a Democratic state legislator, got some significant money from his peers in Raleigh, including Republicans.
Yes.
And he's touting that as a plus, that, look, we need somebody who's not going to antagonize Raleigh. We need somebody who can work with these
legislators. Except at last report, Joel Ford has $96,000, Vi Lyles $106,000, and Jennifer Roberts $230,000.
Well, that's cash on hand.
Oh, exactly, okay. Yeah. Good to define.
Yeah. That's really important. And this actually gets to something that's also really important, which is a campaign's burn rate. Right, that's how much money they're spending and how quickly. So let's take your numbers in order. Joel Ford has $95,000 cash on hand, but he raised $211,000, which means he is spending a lot of money very quickly before potentially voters are paying attention. Then you've got Vi Lyles, who raised $222,000. She's got $106,000 on hand, a little bit of a better position to say the least from Joel Ford. Jennifer Roberts, the mayor, obviously. She raised $369,991. So she's actually ahead of everybody in how much money was raised over the last period. She has already spent $140,000 of that as well. So a lot of this money is being spent possibly before voters are really paying attention, which when it comes to campaigning can be considered wasted money.
So where's this money coming from? Is it coming from all over the country? Is it coming from the states? Within the state, is it coming from big dollar donors? Is it coming from lots of little donors? Where is it coming from?
Yes.
Yeah, it's both. Yeah, and it depends on who you look at. Jennifer Roberts, again, because she was kind of the face, so to speak, of what happened with the non-discrimination ordinance and the HB2 fallout, she's gotten big dollar donations from, the Human Rights Campaign. They gave her more than $5,000. And again, other big donors from across Charlotte and even across the country and then Texas, of all places. She's gotten a lot of support from there. So, I mean, hers varies. As we said, Joel Ford, a lot of his is coming from the State House, but it really varies on just who their base is. And obviously, this is a race that is getting a lot of national attention.
Candidate Me is also running. How much money has Candidate Me raised, Tom?
My little lovely podcast. I'm not going to tell you because I can't believe you asked me that. I'm not going to tell you because it's actually the subject of this next episode, which as soon as the show's over, I have to go back to our other studio and publish it because I actually cold call people to ask for hypothetical donations.
But you haven't filed your disclosure forms. I think we're going to have to do a story on it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we have to FOIA that real quick. Make sure you get that in by the next show.
I just want people, in the interest of full disclosure here, we don't take partisan positions on this program, but both Andrew Dan Doss Helms and I are wearing Candidate Me buttons. So obviously you're going to hit us up for money by the time this thing
there it
you
is.
Need to tell listeners what Candidate Me is in case they're totally confused.
It's
by
a
this.
Podcast that Tom is doing on WFAE to take to see to show the process of running for office, correct?
I am officially not really running for Charlotte mayor, and I'm doing it to be able to show the kind of messy side of campaigning. And I,
and if
we can move on. I was not prepared for this.
And if he wins, he will not serve.
Because officially, I can't. I am immediately automatically disqualified because I don't live in Charlotte.
But it's an interesting way to look at this from the inside. So that's what he's doing, and you can download it at WFAE.org. All right, quickly to education, not to CMS, but to Thunderbird Prep Charter School in Cornelius. You report, Ann, that they've turned to a consultant to help them make a fresh start, but that consultant is under an ethics investigation in South Carolina for what?
Well, she was running a charter school there. She had an arrangement with a business partner in Texas, and they were essentially both, there was a school in Cornelius and a school in Texas, and the Texas school was paying the Cornelius person to be a consultant, then the Cornelius person was paying the Texas person to be a consultant. And the person who is now running this company that's going to manage Thunderbird says it was all on the up and up. I told my board they were fine with it. She also had her husband on the payroll, commissioned another family member to do some work for the school. Again, she says that did not violate South Carolina's laws at the time. When the laws changed, I asked about it. So this has all been reviewed by the Inspector General in South Carolina, who said this does not look great, passed it off to the South Carolina Ethics Commission, who has not yet released a report on whether any laws were violated.
And last summer, we only have a minute left. The last summer in North Carolina,
I knew you were going
to
get me.
That's right. I do it on purpose. Last summer, North Carolina charter school officials put Thunderbird Prep Charter under extra supervision because parent complaints about school leadership, about building safety, and concerns about finances. They're still spending more money than they're bringing in. What's the bottom line here?
It is really hard to turn around a school once things go south and everybody knows about it and that this is a real struggle for them.
Okay. And we haven't had a chance to talk about the Outer Banks. Their power is supposed to be back today,
back
right?
Back on, yeah. Tourists can come back noon Friday.
All right. And we haven't had a chance to talk about fake news, local fake news, but maybe we'll save that for another day. Glenn Brookins from QCityMetro.com and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.